Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to the latest in this OIES podcast series. This is the second of the podcasts we're doing on the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war on energy markets. And with me again today are Mike Fullwood and Jack Sharples to talk about some of the short-term market interactions. And then we've also got Mikhail Maidan with us to talk about Russia's relationship with China and how that might have changed since the start of the war in late February. I think, Mike, I'm going to come to you first, if I may. Last time we talked, we were discussing how LNG was filling some of the hole left by lower Russian supplies. But I think you've got some data now for the whole of Q1. So how do things look for Q1 2022 from an LNG perspective, both for Europe and for the world?
Yes, thank you, Jim. Yeah, we are now have data up to the end of March. So if we're looking at sort of LNG demand, let's say outside Europe, or the flows to the non-European markets, they were down round about year on year compared to Q1 2021, about 9%, about 9 billion cubic metres. It looks like available capacity or supply was up, capacity by about 3.5%. And with a little bit, whatever spare capacity was left last year sort of being exhausted, then a lot of LNG flooded into the European market. And Jack will talk about the flows from Russia. But they were up about 17 billion cubic metres, which is an enormous surge in flows coming into Europe. So on the demand side outside Europe, I mean, there were actually sharp falls in China. And Mikhail will talk about that, India, Japan and Korea. Because it really wasn't as cold this winter as last winter. That accounted for some of it, but not necessarily all of it. Brazil and Chile were also down. It started raining again in Brazil, so they imported a bit less, and in Chile. In terms of Europe, almost every single country was higher, and France was especially significantly higher. However, it's not just Europe. In Indonesia, Malaysia and Thailand in Southeast Asia, imports were higher. Thailand had some issues with Myanmar flows because of the ongoing sort of conflict there. And Kuwait was also higher. On the supply side, then total exports rose by about 8 billion cubic metres. Almost all of this was sort of from the US as the projects from last year ramped up and Sabine Pass Train 6 started to flow gas. Qatar and Algeria were down a little bit. But there was some recovery in Oman, Papua New Guinea, Peru, Malaysia and Indonesia. So this was the beginning really of the unwinding of some of the supply constraints we saw last year. We expect that to continue through the rest of the year.
So Mike, how does that sit then with the target for Europe to import 50 BCM more LNG this year? I mean, you've written about this already and said it's difficult, but given we're up 17 BCM already, put that into the context of the EU target, if you could.
Yeah, I mean, the up until round about sort of August time, then it's a relatively low bar, if you like, to increase LNG imports into Europe compared to last year. So, you know, we've said in comments, insights, and before that 20-25 BCM, maybe even 30 BCM increase compared to 21 is relatively easy to achieve. We should do that. The last 4 months of 2021, energy imports were quite high, so it's probably difficult to increase in the last sort of quarter of this year. But I think certainly 25 BCM increase is relatively easily achievable, depending on what happens in the Asian markets. And this 15 BCM increase in US LNG has probably already been achieved, so I'm not really sure what all that fuss was about.
Great. Well, Jack, let me turn to you now. Last time we spoke about what was happening with Russian flows, and we'll come to that in a second. But I think the other important thing, of course, is what's happening with the alternatives, both indigenous production and non-Russian pipeline flows into Europe. So let's start this time with indigenous European production. What's happening now? And we stand here on the 11th of April. Where are we with European production this year and particularly this month?
Well, certainly European production in March was pretty well flat month on month compared to February. I think the big question is whether that will be sustained in April. Generally speaking, there is a seasonal pattern to European production. So I think that as we go through the next couple of weeks, we should see some of the data coming out to show what's going to be going to be happening, really. Obviously, the big question is around production in the Netherlands at Groningen. The plan is for that to cease in the middle of this calendar year. Whether that still happens or not remains to be seen, but the Dutch government seem pretty certain that they do indeed want to finish the phasing out of Groningen, and it would take a physical disruption in supply for the Netherlands for them to do that.
Okay, so I mean, reasonably positive then for the first quarter, and as much as we haven't gone down, but I guess the big questions to be answered later in the year then. Well, let's talk about some of the other flows into the UK then. What about Norway? Where are we with Norwegian flows? They were making a massive effort to keep flows up. Is that continuing?
Yes, it is. So if we look at the flows to the UK via the Lange Led pipeline, but also their flows to France and Belgium through the Fram pipe and the Z pipe, those are pretty well stable month on month. They are already operating at full capacity. Where we have seen an incremental growth, even just month on month, is the Norwegian flow through the Norpipe and Europipes to Germany and the Netherlands. I think there we are getting closer now to full capacity. The growth in flows in early April is up by about 6 million cubic metres per day compared to March, which equates to about 2.2 BCM per year equivalent, which is sitting pretty well in line with some of the promises of increased Norwegian production for this calendar year.
Okay, and in terms of then North Africa, which is the other sort of, not big hope, but the other option, if you like, I note that that Eni have been to visit the Algerians to talk about increased flows. What are we seeing there, and what are the prospects, both for pipeline gas, and if you can say anything about LNG as well, that would be useful.
Sure. So if we think about the Algerian flows to Spain, then they are pretty solid month on month. We're looking at about 30 million cubic metres a day there. We are looking at a loss year on year in those flows simply because of the cessation of gas transit via Morocco to Spain. In terms of the Algerian deliveries to Italy via the Transmed pipeline, again, they are pretty well solid at around 60 million cubic metres per day, and actually have been since the start of the present winter. So we haven't really seen much of a ramp up there, even though there is some physical spare capacity on the pipeline. And then finally, in terms of pipeline flows from North Africa, the Libyan flows are actually down slightly year on year. They were fairly low to begin with, about 8 to 10 million cubic metres per day during the first quarter of last year. Now we're down to about 4 or 5 million cubic metres per day. But that's very much the result of ongoing developments inside Libya.
Okay, so not looking quite so optimistic in terms of a kind of boost this year. What about the Azeri tap flows? I mean, I was thought we were pretty much at full capacity there as well. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So we are pretty much at full capacity. There's been an incremental growth at the start of April, just by sort of 1 or 2 million cubic metres per day compared to last month. But where we are right now is just a shade over 30 million cubic metres per day. Now, as Mike said, in terms of Europe's LNG imports, the big hope for Azeri gas this year is that the year-on-year increase will all occur during the first half of the year, simply because last year was when the TAP pipeline was launched and the first half of the year was its ramping up period. Whereas in the second half of 2021, the flows were at least 25 million cubic metres per day in terms of monthly average in the second half of 2021. So there's less scope, let's say, for a year-on-year increase in the second half of this year. So I think the advice is to fill your boots right now before the end of the second quarter.
Fair enough. Okay. So then we should turn to Russian flows. I mean, you know, obviously the situation seems optimistic to an extent for Azerbaijan, but pretty flat elsewhere. What's been happening to Russian flows, it's particularly in April, since our last podcast?
Well, the big symbolic development is the cessation of physical flows from Russia to the three Baltic states. Once you net out the onward flows via Lithuania to Kaliningrad, the volumes were not particularly large to begin with. And in any case, what we saw normally in the region was quite a seasonal trend to the flows, in the sense that the Russian flows ramped up during the summer. The large storage facility in Latvia at Inčukalns was filled, and then the flows dropped off during the winter. So I think what we're potentially going to see over the next couple of months is that normally when Russian gas would flow into the region to refill the capacity at Inčukalns, that may not happen. We may see Latvian storage actually being refilled by LNG imported from elsewhere. But I think what is potentially an issue here is the fact that whilst Lithuania and Estonia are not locked into long-term contracts with Gazprom, Latvia is, through Latvia's Gaza. So I think it's almost like a test case for the rest of Europe in terms of ramping down Russian imports while still being tied into a long-term contract.
Okay, and what about the main pipes then? What about Nord Stream, Yamal, Europe? What about the Ukraine system? Give us a quick overview of what's been happening in April there.
Well, in Northwest Europe, Nord Stream 1 is back at full capacity after a slight dip in March, which we think was related to Gazprom's German counterparties nominating down under their long-term contracts. We've seen some fluctuations around the Yamal Europe pipeline. I think what's quite crucial to note right now is that gas is flowing along that pipeline into Poland, but it's not being delivered onward to Germany. So effectively, it's only Poland that's physically receiving gas via that pipeline. We have seen some fits and starts of physical reverse flows from Germany into Poland. Again, we think that's probably German traders selling spot into the Polish market. And again, it's all about the balance between off-takers like PGNiG and how they're treating their long-term contracts with Gazprom and the flexibility that they have within that. In terms of alternative Russian flows elsewhere, in late March, flows via Ukraine, particularly at Velika Kapushani into Central Europe, which is the main route via Ukraine for Russian gas, were actually pretty strong. But we've seen a dramatic drop off since the 6th of April, between the 6th and the 9th of April, where exit flows at Velika Kapushani dropped from 90 million cubic meters a day to about 62 million cubic meters per day, which in relative terms is quite a significant development. So we're going to be watching for the next couple of weeks to see how that plays out. And then finally, we have the flows via Turkish Stream, which have been, again, really relatively stable. Nothing too dramatic there. So I think that really the big question for Russian gas at the moment is what's going to happen with the flexibility around the Yamal Europe line? What's going to happen with the flexibility through Ukraine into Central Europe at Velika Kapushani?
Okay, so continuing, well, I guess particularly with Ukraine, a story of falling flows, but I think LNG send-out's been particularly strong. I mean, Mike was talking about, you know, the global market and the amount of LNG that's coming to Europe. So what's been happening with LNG send-out?
Well, absolutely. So as Mike mentioned, European LNG imports have been very strong for the last couple of months. And actually, March was a new record for European LNG imports. And that is now being, the effects of that are now being felt in terms of the LNG send out from the storage tanks. So actually, in March, LNG send out across Europe, excluding Turkey, was about 388 million cubic meters per day as a monthly average. In the first 10 days of April, that's up to 441 million cubic meters per day. So we are seeing a real wave of LNG now actually being regasified and injected into the European system.
Good. And the last time we spoke, you gave me some positive news on storage. I mean, I'm hearing that LNG story. I'm presuming the storage numbers continue to look relatively positive.
Yes, absolutely. So in the first few days of April, the first week of April, we've actually seen the first of consecutive days of notable storage injections. So it seems that this wave of LNG that's being regasified and injected into the European systems is at least to a certain extent being injected into European storage. As it stands, the latest data that we have for the 8th of April shows that stock levels are back to their same level as they were on that date in 2017. So that's about 27.7 BCM. And at the present rate of injections, we should actually be back to last year's level by about the 18th of April. In terms of getting to the 80 BCM of stocks by the 1st of November, that will require about 52 BCM of injections this summer, which is about 4 BCM more than in the same period in 2021. So that could potentially align with the hoped for increase in supply from non-Russian sources.
Okay, interesting. So yeah, things looking reasonably positive on the storage front, which I guess gives us an indication of where flows are overall. Mike, let me come back to you, if I may, on prices. I mean, given those flows, I guess you'd expect prices to be coming down. I suspect you're going to tell me they're not. So give us an update on prices.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, who knows what happened to prices? I mean, they're kind of all over the place. I think the market really is in a state of huge uncertainty about whether Russia will cut off supplies if they don't get the money in rubles, or whether the EU will sanction imports like some countries want to do on the ground that payments are fueling the Russian war machines. I mean, prices have been very volatile since the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, going up very sharply following the invasion. And then as flows continued, actually not just continued, but as Jack said, nominations were a lot higher, so flows increased as the war started. And the price then came back down a little bit. But then we had a few comments by Russia that might cut off because of sanctions, and then the EU coming in with a two-thirds reduction. So we had prices bouncing around sort of all over the place. What Jack was saying, you might have expected prices to come down. And if you look at the whole of the first quarter, the high prices suggest the market might have tightened further as it was doing in 2021, but it doesn't look as though it has. LNG supply appears to be plentiful, with demand outside Europe, as we said, sort of down, supply up. Even though Russia pipe imports are down significantly, and there's some easing of non-Russian pipe imports as well, it does look like demand in Europe was down quite a lot as well. So the whole market looks like it might have loosened slightly compared to the first quarter of 2021, which would suggest that prices actually should have come down. But I think the uncertainty just kept them up.
And just to fix it, on today, we're basically around 100 euros a megawatt hour at the moment. So having been as high as 225 and down sort of towards 75 at some periods before the war started.
Yes, it appears to be sort of stabilizing at sort of that sort of level the last couple of weeks, with a little bit few ups and downs. But yes, it's still probably significantly higher than the prices should have been, considering where we are on the global supply demand balance, and the higher because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the uncertainty.
And I know today, Mike, you've had a note out on what you think is the kind of EU binary choice. And you make the point in the note that it's this uncertainty that's keeping prices high, and that the EU basically needs to decide either that it is going to embargo all Russian imports and therefore reduce Russian revenues, or it has a different choice to make around actually allowing nominations under contracts. Could you just explain your theory?
Well, I think obviously the political aim of reducing imports from Russia is to hit Russia's revenues from gas sales, so thereby reducing flows. If that just causes prices to shoot up, then that's not really the solution. I mean, if you reduce imports by two-thirds and the price triples, revenues remain the same. So it seems to me that this current situation is just creating more uncertainty. I think there may be a sort of misunderstanding, certainly amongst maybe the governments and politicians, about what contract gas is. Contract gas is not spot gas. I mean, the buyers have already agreed to buy that gas. They're just deciding on when they want to take it. So they have a choice, basically, to satisfy their demand. They can draw on contract gas, take it out of storage, or buy spot gas in the market. So if they call on more contract gas, that means they don't have to go to the market to buy gas. So that eases the pressure on the market and on buying spot gas, and then eases pressure on prices. So nominating more under the contracts actually adds to supply. So when politicians say we're buying more Russian gas, well, we're not buying more Russian gas. We've already agreed to buy it. We're just taking what we've agreed to buy in a more timely manner. So I think that's where some of the confusion is.
And so you're basically advocating that the EU either says we're taking no Russian gas at all and we're effectively breaking the contracts, or we should encourage buyers to nominate up to their contracted quantities in order to ease the pressure on the market and make it very clear that that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two options. I mean, neither of them, as you say, continues with the current fudge of reducing imports, as that won't reduce revenues to Russia. So you impose sanctions, stop the flows and the contracts completely. I mean, obviously, issues surrounding breach of contract, if take or pay payments aren't made, or possible force majeure would keep lawyers employed for many years. And so that's something to talk about in another podcast, maybe. But it would immediately stop Russian revenues, but comes at a heavy cost to European economies and potentially very large increases in gas electricity prices to consumers, with severe knock-on effects to prices all around the world, to other importers, raising energy costs. Very damaging, particularly to developing countries. They can barely afford the LNG now. Can you imagine what it would like if prices went up higher? And that could well last for a long time if you know, you cut off flows, it's very easy to cut them off. It's very difficult to restart them. Under what circumstances do you do that? So we could have high global energy costs for years to come. But even the surge in LNG supply from the mid-2020s onwards, plus possibly more FIDs taken this year and next, that would still not be enough to replace all the lost supply from Russia. So it's a real problem. And the second option, we think, as you said, with the EU or at least relevant national governments, to be absolutely clear that they will continue to take all gas from Russia under long-term contracts and will abide by them. To the extent possible, encourage buyers to nominate the maximum on those contracts if they can do that. And with more supply in the market and one source of uncertainty removed, that the EU will reduce imports, that actually could bring prices down substantially and actually reduce revenues going to Russia compared to where they are at the moment, and certainly compared to where they would be if you tried to reduce imports by two-thirds.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting theory, and I think the logic would appear to be impeccable. I think politically it's obviously somewhat controversial, so I would encourage readers to look out Mike's note, which is on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org now. You can see his logic and decide for yourselves whether you are a buyer of that theory or not. But Mike, thanks for explaining it. I think it's very clear. A very good piece of research. Mikhail, I'm going to turn to you now because obviously we've talked about the global LNG market and we've mentioned already that demand for LNG is actually lower than 2021, which is obviously helping out Europe. From a Chinese perspective, can you see that carrying on? Is this a theme for 2022, or is this just a short-term phenomenon? Actually, we're going to see more competition in the rest of the year.
It's certainly a theme for the next few months. And as Mike mentioned, Chinese demand for LNG and more broadly has been quite weak. The first quarter was expected. We had the Winter Olympics and we had industrial curtailments ahead of that to reduce pollution. But I think there was an expectation that demand would rebound right about now. But of course, with the zero COVID tolerance policy, the lockdowns in Shanghai and Shenzhen and a number of other cities, that is weighing on economic activity and therefore on gas demand. And I think that will remain the case for another couple of months. What happens in the second half of the year, I think, is an open question, because the government has issued a GDP growth target of 5.5% for this year. Now, that has to be made up somehow, right? The government says, and the government will try to achieve it. We've talked about this in previous podcasts. 2022 is a political year with huge importance, as there's a leadership transition in November. So everything has to look great and everything has to go off smoothly, and the economy needs to come roaring back. If there is a stimulus, and at this point it will have to be a sort of heavy infrastructure type industrial stimulus, that will lead to greater gas demand growth and inevitably to LNG demand growth in the second half of the year. And I think that's when we might see the competition increase between Europe and China.
Okay, well, and if that competition does increase, I guess there's been a lot of talk about the relationship between Russia and China. Is there anything that happens with Russian gas to China in the short term that can alleviate that competitive pressure in the LNG market?
Not completely. I mean, there is the additional flows on the Power of Siberia, and those were scheduled. So last year, there was 10 BCM flowing through the Power of Siberia, one, obviously, and this year, we're expecting another 4 to 5 BCM. But again, that was scheduled. There could be some more LNG that's redirected, sort of if other buyers don't want it and if China's willing to pay for it, it could be redirected to China, but nothing sort of earth-shattering, no huge volumes. And of course, the pipelines, if they don't, any pipeline volumes that don't flow to Europe cannot flow to China because they're not linked. There's not, those flows cannot be redirected. So in the near term, Russia can't really help out massively with any potential shortages or competition with Europe.
So the Russia-China gas relationship really then is all about the medium to long term, I guess. And there's been, not any discussion, there have been agreements about extra supply coming on. Can you talk us through those a bit? I mean, I had heard there'd been an extension and expansion of the Power of Siberia 1 contract from 38 to 44 BCM. Has that materialised?
That has not materialized sort of in anything concrete. It doesn't mean it won't happen and there aren't sort of plans to increase Power of Siberia 1 to 44 BCM. But the agreement that was signed between China and Russia in early February was for an additional 10 BCM.
it's not completely clear. Sort of, there were no details on where that would come from and how that would be delivered to China, but it will probably be delivered from Sakhalin. And those 10 BCM would start flowing at best in early 2024, 2025. So again, this is a sort of a medium-term fix. Now, of course, that, and especially if there was another 8 BCM on Power of Siberia, that those are additional volumes that will help Chinese demand. They come in through northern China, and there's the infrastructure that's been built out to deliver them to the rest of China, but that infrastructure does need to be developed within the country. Again, for now, Power of Siberia 1 and the sort of related infrastructure within China is being developed on schedule. But for an additional 10 BCM, as early as 2025, we need to see a lot more happening, both on the upstream in Russia, but also on the midstream in China very, very quickly. And we don't have that clarity yet.
And I mean, you've mentioned prices, and we know that, well, Asian buyers have been buying Russian crude at huge discounts. Is there any indication on the price negotiations for this extra gas? I mean, are they getting a good deal? Do we know?
They're getting a good deal on Power of Siberia 1. And to a certain degree, these additional volumes, be it the 8 BCM that was going to bring it to 44 BCM, or if this is an additional 10, they seem to have been baked into the original negotiations. At the end of last year, Power of Siberia was delivered, Russian pipeline gas was delivered at around $4 per MMBTU at the Chinese border. You know, when we think of pipeline gas into China from Central Asia in February, which the latest data we have, was delivered at $6.5 per MMBTU. Most of the term contracts, the LNG term contracts, came in at around $11 per MMBTU, but there were some spot cargoes at $40 per MMBTU. So, you know, $4 per MMBTU is a very good price, and I think we can assume that any future contract will be at similar or even better terms, but that would not be great for Russia.
Indeed not, which brings us to the next question, which is the big pipeline that everyone is now talking about is Power of Siberia 2, of course, which could link West Siberia via Mongolia to Northeast China. What's the state of play there? Are we seeing active negotiations and a kind of real hope that this could happen in this decade?
Certainly a real hope on the Russian side, where I think all the talk from Europe, and not just talk, but action to reduce reliance on Russian gas, is accelerating the need to pivot east and to reinforce the relationships, the kind of eastbound contract and the relationship with China. There has been sort of, you know, radio silence on additional energy projects since early February, but I think it's likely that Power of Siberia 2 will happen. The Russians have already been discussing and negotiating with the Mongolians. There are talks about feasibility studies and sort of the route being laid, or at least being marked in Mongolia. Nothing to suggest that any agreement has happened on the Chinese side either. But, you know, with Russian necessity and growing international isolation, China's need for the gas, it does seem likely that a Power of Siberia, that an additional big deal will be signed in the next few years. But even then, the flows don't really start before 2030. And again, so in the next decade, China still needs a lot of LNG for its incremental demand as Power of Siberia 1 ramps up and its domestic supplies continue to increase.
I mean, you mentioned LNG there. Is there any thought that Chinese investors might take a bigger role in some of the Russian LNG projects that have been called into question, if you like, since February 24th? I'm thinking particularly more investment in the Arctic region. Has there been any talk about that?
They certainly could. And, you know, we saw in 2014 that Chinese companies and financial institutions benefited from Russia's growing isolation. I think what's happening this time, we are seeing much more caution from China. And that coincides with greater concern in the West, or greater concern and about sort of China's positioning and attitudes towards Russia. Of course, China has not condemned the invasion into Ukraine. China is towing this line of sort of not taking non-interference and trying not to take sides. But I think the Chinese are acutely aware that they could be exposed to Western sanctions, and they're not willing to push those boundaries in order to please Russia, in order to remain or in order to actively stay sort of on Russia's side. So I think anything that is negotiations and contractual, sort of anything that would be binding contractually, will have to wait until China sees where the wind is blowing and how it can make sure that its companies avoid any kind of sanctions, again, direct sanctions or secondary sanctions. But the appetite in the West as well, the EU-China summit and the first, just last week, there were veiled threats, I think, from Ursula von der Leyen to say, look, Chinese companies are going to have to be very careful. They're going to see European companies trying to leave China. But the everything is still up in the air. And I think, again, China's going to be very, very cautious.
OK, so a bit early to say that China's a real winner out of this situation then. I mean, it's as you say, being very cautious, and it'll be some time before the gas arrives anyway. So not really a huge victory yet for China in terms of its gas relations with Russia.
No, not quite yet. And again, in this year, it's hugely complicated. It's not just the energy flows. Remember, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has led to increases in prices of everything, energy, other agricultural commodities. It's weighing on the Chinese economy. So this year, it's hugely complicated. I think before China does any potential sort of victory laps about gains and future projects, that again, I think it could gain at quite concessionary terms, it will want to ride out this year and see what are the potential downsides and any implications of these commercial associations with Russia. Long term, it does stand to benefit, but in the short term, a huge amount of caution.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's a good place to conclude. So Mike, Jack and Mikhail, thank you very much indeed for your contributions. Obviously, the gas program at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies continues to follow the Russia-Ukraine war and its impacts on energy markets. And you can find all our research on our website. So please do look there. And we'll be doing another podcast on the up-to-date issues in the next week or so. So look out for that as well. But in the meantime, thank you very much indeed for listening. Please stay healthy and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.